A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online, so any small business could be a driving force to create change or build an empire. We know old ideas aren't cutting it anymore, so we're calling for a new generation of thinking, your way of thinking. So whatever you have in mind that will help make a different future, find everything you need to get started at GoDaddy.com. Because the future isn't decided yet. It's up to us to make it happen. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
This is an ode to Napa cabbage. Of all the cabbages on all the cabbage farms, only you have the crisp crunch worthy of our Bibigo Korean dumplings. No other cabbage would do, because no other cabbage tastes like you. We love you, Napa cabbage. Just don't tell Green Onion. Napa cabbage, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every hearty, flavorful Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hi there, it's Mark. Garnett, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing today?
Doing fine. It's a beautiful fall day in New England. What's it like out there on the coast?
I don't know why you ask me that every single time. I say the same thing every single time. And people like you and our upcoming guest on this episode, you always get mad at me because it's sunny. It's sunny and pleasant here. Bit of a heat wave, though. Going to be in the 90s.
You haven't had any wildfires near you, have you?
No. Nothing like that. But there is ash in the air.
Yeah.
You can see it on the car, stuff like that. But that's way further north, thank goodness. I mean, yeah. No ill will towards the folks in Silicon Valley. Oh, no, fuck that. Plenty of ill will towards the people in Silicon Valley, actually, come to think of it.
Yeah, but not for the fires.
Yeah.
We could see the ash in the sunsets about a month ago. It was really golden, even here on the East Coast.
Are you sure that wasn't just the dirt and the smog in the air, right, around Boston?
Yeah, I think I read something about it, that it actually was the smoke. Who knows? In the end, it all just circles around the globe anyway.
Yeah. Today, our guest is William Crowder from Aperture VC, most recently, but with a long track record and history behind him. William is a computer scientist, a management consultant, and to some extent, an accidental VC when he started his VC career back in 2011-ish, 2010. He'll detail that. But has since gone on to create an amazing track record in diversity investing. And for my money, is really the elder statesman in this space of diversity investing. And he's very much in catbird seat at this point going forward. I think you're going to hear a lot about William and what he's doing with Aperture VC in 2021. So without further ado, hello, William.
Thanks for having me.
It's great having you here. We want to start by talking about your background and the major life and work and milestones that prepared you for the work you're doing with Aperture VC. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I always approach these types of questions with some apprehension because I don't want to give away how old I really am or how young I actually am.
Everybody on the iPod is 29, just so you know.
Right. I'll pick up the story in the middle somewhere. But I am originally from North Carolina, born, raised, educated there. One of my careers was as a management consultant, working for some large corporations, or I should say working on behalf of some large corporations in an effort to help them figure out growth strategies and other, you know, finding answers to a lot of other challenging problems. In another career that I had, I was a software engineer. And in another career that I had, which is probably the one that's most relevant to this conversation,
yeah,
has been as a VC, as a professional investor. I started doing that in 2011, yeah. And most of that work began working with a startup accelerator, which is called Dream It, where I got an opportunity to work with some really early stage companies, working with founders that just had, in many ways, it was just a team and a dream. And caught the bug from there that led to other opportunities, one of those being running a fund on behalf of Comcast, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more. which was in effect the first corporate-backed venture fund with a focus on diversity. And so I helped to put that together and launch that fund and ran that for several years, found my way over to Morgan Stanley and have been helping them do something somewhat similar, investing in early stage startups, those that have diverse founders, and helped them build a program there. And here we are today. So I have done a tremendous amount of work at the intersection of venture capital, diversity, and tech. I'm excited about some of the new things that I'm going to be doing. And I know we'll get into that as well. But that's been me in a nutshell. Yeah. Someone who wears a lot of different hats, much like other folks in this conversation.
How transferable were your skills as a developer into venture capital? Did it help you understand technology first off? Or are there kind of organizational skills that you have in your head that you can use every day?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that while I'll never say that, oh, my computer science degree was useless. I have two of them, so I can't say that. But I think the thing that has been most beneficial has been, it shaped the way that I think about problem solving.
Yeah.
And to give it some structure, there's and I don't know if this is a real word, there's an iterativeness to problem solving that you find very frequently in solving problems from a computer science perspective, from a software development perspective. The stuff you do is about recursion. And you just continue to iterate and iterate and iterate until you get a better and better solution until ultimately you get the solution. I think that's probably the thing, the biggest impact that it's had for me.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's also a place where I, at least for the way that I work and the way that I think, there are a few avenues for me to really just, I operate in a way that I'm constantly thinking about problems and solving them and always kind of working through something that I haven't quite figured out the answer to. And sometimes I do that even unconsciously. And so this was one of the few avenues where I could kind of put all of that energy to good use. I mean, sometimes I'll just wake up in the middle of the night and I have an answer to the problem. I know exactly how I want to solve this particular issue, or I want to code in this particular way. Years ago, I would do that. And so I can continue to do that now. And I have those moments when I wake up in the morning, I'm like, okay, I know exactly what it is we need to do. So
yeah,
it's work.
Yeah, that's great. So we like to have people on this show who are big deals, and you are definitely a big deal. You're a diversity investing pioneer, which is not just a big deal, it's a huge deal. So how do you define diversity in the early stage venture world? And why is it even a thing?
Yeah.
Why does it have to be a thing?
That's like, ask me, why do I have to be a big deal then, Mark? That doesn't make sense.
But you are a big deal.
No, I really don't see myself that way, but I understand why, especially in 2020, why that would be the observation and why people ask the questions that they ask, similar to the ones that you just asked. The short answer is that it shouldn't.
Right.
The short answer is that it should not be a big deal. It shouldn't even be a conversation to be had. It should just be natural as we speak English in America. Like, it just should be what happens. The reality, it's in this country, it's never been what's happened.
Yeah.
This country is built with a perspective that certain people can do certain things under certain circumstances. And you protect that structure to the death.
Yeah.
To be honest, like, that's what we've seen. So in order to change that, you're in many ways, you're in a fight to the death to change it, right? Like, because it's going to be defended to that extent. I think I said this, and Garnett and I had a conversation about this not that long ago. I think I said something to the effect of, I've been a popular VC for like 3 months now. It literally almost felt like it happened overnight, and there were some unfortunate circumstances that happened. But it put this conversation back on the national stage, but it did so with a different context. We've had these conversations. We had this conversation in 2010 through 2012. We had this conversation again, 2014 to 2015, and now we're having it again. People feel like it's different this time. My fingers are crossed that it is. I think the circumstances surrounding it are different. And as a result, we are getting a different type of conversation. Now, whether we're going to get a different kind of action, that's to be seen. Mm-hmm. But the first steps have been happening. The first indications are there. And the question is whether or not this can be sustained. And then just the last thing I'll say about all of that is, I'm in this space out of pure, it was just great opportunity. It wasn't because of my intent. I didn't set out to become a VC. I certainly didn't set out to be a quote unquote diversity VC. But when I got the opportunity to be a VC, I wanted to do really well. And it just so happened that the platform that I had was one that was tied to the lack of diversity in the space. And so in order to do well, I had to do that part well. And then there was a question at some point about whether or not what I was doing was going to be seen as, hey, you're a great investor, or you're a great investor in diverse founders. And to me, those two things should not, cannot be separated. You just are good or you're not. And I would argue that if you have not been investing in diverse founders, then you're not a good investor. I don't care how much money you've made. Because what you're doing is you are reinforcing a perspective that has prevented a wide swath of this population from being able to show the rest of the world what they can do.
So for the benefit of the audience, William and I have known each other since 2015, 2016, and we share a really long friendship with someone that we're both friends with in common. And so feel like we know each other maybe more than just the 5 years that we've been in each other's orbit. And we'll talk more about why we're in each other further in the podcast. But there's a quote that's out there, and there's a thought leader that's out there right now. And I'm curious how you personally and professionally respond to some of the things that Darren Walker at Ford Foundation has been putting out in the press, wherein basically he says corporate America has failed. And I'm paraphrasing, corporate America has failed Black America. What does that even mean? That's a broad, damning statement.
Yeah.
How do you take that?
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about. I think it was an article in the New York Times or something, and I can't remember the rest of that. But even paraphrasing, that was the essence of what he said, was exactly that, right? And I think the issue Darren and I think many others have been trying to bang home, and Robert Smith is another who has been really kind of on this topic, is that American, in particular, American corporations have been built on the backs of Black America. They're inextricably linked in so many different ways. And that's not to say that, oh, well, it's only because of Black Americans that any of these companies exist. That's not what we're saying. But you cannot be a corporation and be successful and not recognize and acknowledge that you're there and you are because of others that were willing to do the things that allowed you to generate the kind of revenue that you've generated and be as successful as you've been. And so if you fully appreciate and understand that, then what you cannot do is turn your back on that same group of people in this particular moment. That can't be a company that has zero representation in your leadership, that doesn't reflect the fact that there's quite a few African Americans in this country, many of which are more than capable to be a senior leader at your company, to be in charge of your company, to be on your board, to reap the benefits of your strategic capabilities and assets. And that last piece is critical because it forces corporations to really think about, well, what can we actually do? That's not just what I consider to be just the token response, which is, hey, let's put a Black person on the board. That is literally the least you can do. What they have to start thinking about is we've got all of this capability. We have all these different assets, financial, human, et cetera. How do we use those for the betterment of the overall economy and society? And as a result, how do we respond to the needs and the calls for action from the Black community? And up until this point, by and large, unless a corporation has been forced to the table, they don't generally respond in a way that says, I recognize there is a disparity. I recognize that there are some challenges, and I recognize we have a capability to do something about it. They just don't do that. That's not their natural reaction. And I think what Darren is trying to do is bring attention to the fact that, I mean, he runs a huge foundation and endowment. I think they're like $14 billion. He can do something about it. He knows that money is coming from a lot of large corporations, and therefore they will follow his lead. So he's going to be very vocal about the fact they can do more and then issue that challenge. And I think in many ways, Garnett and I both have another person in common who said this to us, and we've not moved off of it, which is the fact that corporations have a fiduciary responsibility to do something here and to be active in this moment. And to not do so would be to be in their own duties running these large corporations that are owned by people all over the world, in particular people in this country.
Yeah. So I want to talk about Comcast, which kind of is a follow-on to that.
That's a perfect segue.
It's one of those companies that I think, because it's a media company, has kind of an outsized influence on society, because you get your TV through Comcast, you get NBC, you get all these media vehicles. And if they were selling aluminum cans, they wouldn't really be that big of a player. But they're a huge player in corporate America and in the life of Americans. And I'd like to learn about your experience and the origin of the Comcast Catalyst. This is an example of what you were just talking about, right?
Yeah.
And it was Comcast Diversity Fund, and maybe the first of its kind in the country. Can you tell us about how it came to be?
Yeah, sure. So somewhere around, I can't remember the exact year, somewhere around 2009, 2010, somewhere in there, is when Comcast made it known that it wanted to acquire NBC. And major, major deal, as you can imagine, turns them into the world's largest media company if successful. Ultimately, it was successful. But some of the things that people are not aware of is that in the process of getting that deal approved and getting regulatory approval out of DC, there were a lot of folks in DC that were not happy about the prospects of those two companies joining forces. There were political leaders, elected officials, who felt like if that's going to happen, then basically something needs to happen for the benefit of my own district, my own constituents, so that they don't get screwed in the process. From a diversity perspective, as one example, there were folks in the Congressional Black Caucus, there were folks in the Hispanic Caucus that were just opposed to the deal, unless something more could be provided that will give them something to go back to their districts with, because it's politics. It is what it is. All politics are local. But also, in optimistically speaking, from a greater good, like, hey, this is an opportunity to extract some value that can be therefore returned to the folks that basically created. And I'll give you a couple of perfect examples very quickly. One of those was that there were a bunch of assets that NBC held that were going to have to be disposed of. There was going to have to be an asset sale. And there were expectations, because of this potential combination, that those assets were going to be sold to a more diverse set of business owners, folks that were Latino or perhaps African-American. And why was that the case? It was the case because those very same assets, television assets, were operating in markets that were as much as 40% of color, and they had no one on the air that represented those communities.
Yeah.
And so this was the only way to start to guarantee some level of recognition that was unacceptable going forward. So that was one. The other that came out of this, and there were several, but one that I'll talk about, which led to the Catalyst Fund, basically, was that it was clear then that the access to capital was severely lacking when it came to venture capital. When it came to supporting entrepreneurs, there just wasn't much corporate support for it whatsoever. Forget whether or not it was support, broadly speaking, because there wasn't there either. So it was an opportunity to create a vehicle that could be supportive of that. And so Comcast proposed that they would create a venture fund that would be run by their own corporate venture arm, that would invest in people of color. It was set with a budget of $20 million. And like I said, it would be managed by the folks at Comcast Ventures. And that was one of a variety of different concessions that were made in the process of getting a deal approved and things that Comcast signed up to be held accountable for.
Yeah.
And so this was back in 2010-ish, 2011. Certainly 2010, 2011 was when the first time I think there was a public announcement about that fund. And in many ways, all those different concessions and commitments that Comcast made back then, these are the same commitments that people are making today, just with a different source of motivation. In that case, it was a very specific deal that they wanted to get approved. And in today's case, it's in many ways, it's somewhat of a proactive response to the murder of George Floyd, but people are kind of following the same playbook, whether they recognize it and realize it or not.
How can you discern when something like that is genuine or a reaction to trying to stay ahead of the news cycle, do you think?
I think it's always the latter. And whether or not there's a genuine effort, I look at the top. I look at the people who are directly involved, not just the people who are quoted in the press release, But then it's that next decision. It's who do you put in charge of that effort and whether or not I can draw a straight line between that particular individual or individuals to the issue at hand.
Right.
And can I trust that connection will remain no matter what? When you talk to folks today, if you talk to some of the people over at PayPal, as an example, they are incredibly effusive about Dan Schulman and his commitment in the moment to say, hey, PayPal is going to devote $530 million towards economic justice. And we're going to do all these different things to make that a reality. I don't know him. I've never met him. I've met people who know him really well, and they speak very highly of him. And one of the things they say is that he decided that their commitment was going to be bigger. And that's how it got to $530 million. And it was largely because he was listening to other people whose opinion he valued. And he recognized that in this moment, he felt like he had a company that could do more. And so they did more. And so I can take him at his word and take him at his actions, but I would put that against a lot of other people and say, well, if you ask me who's more authentic about this or who's more genuine about it, without even meeting him, I'm willing to bet that he's more than some of the other folks. And I'll just, we'll just kind of leave it at that. I don't know that there's anything else to judge. I think that many Black people in this country would say, we don't even care why. You know, we want to see the work actually get done. We want to see the capital actually allocated. We don't want it to be a half-assed response. And I think that's what we're looking for more than anything else out of corporate America and out of individuals. And I think that's where a lot of things have been very inconsistent. So that's the source of cynicism that people have, which I think is healthy and should be respected because the reasons for that are well documented.
Right.
COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
So let's talk about another step in your career, helping architect Morgan Stanley's Multicultural Innovation Lab. I guess how challenging was that to start with? And then we had COVID happen. How did that affect you? And what have you learned along the way?
So it's funny that you bring it up because now that I think about it, this is actually a perfect example of the question you just asked me about how do you know if it's genuine? The person that's in charge of the lab at Morgan Stanley is Carla Harris. Carla Harris is 30 plus year veteran of Morgan Stanley, phenomenal Black woman who's been a tremendous leader at that company for many, many years. And not many African Americans on Wall Street can say that they have not been affected by her in some way, shape, or form. It's always been positive.
Yeah.
Carla and I had built up a relationship while I was at Comcast, as it turns out. And she came to me when she found out I was going to be leaving, and she asked if I would help them in that particular moment build this accelerator for women and people of color. She felt like the moment was right at Morgan Stanley and that she wanted to do something that was fundamentally different in the space. And so they asked me, can you help us figure out what we should do and more importantly, what we should not do? And so that's how this whole thing kind of happened. We did some hardcore work for a few months, put together a program, and then we launched it in the spring of 2017 with just five companies. And it was really a trial balloon to see if we could actually make it work and to demonstrate to Morgan Stanley that it could work. And even to a certain extent, proving the idea that there were venture-backable entrepreneurs that happened to be African-American and or women that could garner legitimate support from VCs and put together a story in a company that would be worthy of even more. And so when we conceived of it then in 2017, it was an in-person program. I live in Philly. The companies are going to be in New York, and I was in New York every single week.
Are you an Eagles fan?
I'm not. So I live in Philly. I am from North Carolina. So I'm a Charlottean. So
yeah,
whatever comes out of Charlotte, I'm a fan of. But we did it with the expectation of being in person with the entrepreneurs all the time. COVID hit in our fourth year this year. And I think that it was a challenge for the organization on the front end, because if people go back and think about what was happening in February and March, no one really thought that the virus was going to be what it is today. And so this reaction to what was happening in many ways was slow at first. And then you got the reality that we have to do something. And then you just figure it out. And so for this thing, I do work all over the country. So I'm very much a virtual worker anyway. So it's easier for me to make that adjustment than perhaps others. Ironically, at Morgan Stanley, we had brand new space for the companies. It had just been built out. I actually haven't seen it. So the company's got a chance to move into it for like 3 days. And that same week, I decided I wasn't going to New York because I was concerned about the virus. Yeah. So
I'm sure the space is beautiful.
That's what I hear. I hear it's phenomenal. But so we adjusted on the fly. We actually had a debrief this right before this call because we just wrapped up the program. And to be honest with you, it has probably been better. It's been better than I expected it would be. I think people have made the adjustment. The companies have made the adjustment. Morgan Stanley's made the adjustment. I think there's still a desire to be able to communicate and interact in person. I think people are still figuring out how to build relationships where there was no relationship to begin with, building that online first, and perhaps that being the only way it exists for an unforeseen amount of time. So we'll see how that plays out, and there's a role technology can play there, et cetera. But by and large, I think that the virtual program is absolutely effective in a way. It is effective. And I think the one last thing that we needed to have in terms of a domino to fall, the big question people had was, is the investor community going to also follow suit here and be willing to make commitments to entrepreneurs they've never met in person? And that was a big question mark in March. It is not a question mark in October. Deals are happening. People are acknowledging and accepting the reality. And I think they're probably too busy trying to figure out how to manage the fact that their kids are at home to worry about the entrepreneurs. They're just trying to make sure they don't have one less problem. So I think people are willing to do it more so now than they were before.
Yeah, sounds great.
Quick question. William, back on day one of Comcast Catalyst, So there was some backstory and some of it was political, some of it was industry, all this sort of thing. And you described that really well. Was there any dialogue at all about the allocation of VC monies into diverse startups, into Black, brown, and female startups? Was there any discussion about, my pet peeve is always around data, right? Because you can't fix what you haven't measured. And so anytime I look around the world and see stuff that's not being measured, I see just me. I'm paranoid. I see conspiracy. So but at the beginning, was there any discussion at all about what had happened in the first bubble from 2001 to 2010 as far as VC allocations? Because that was a pivotal moment, 2010, 2011.
Yeah, I mean, there was a study that had been put out from CB Insights, I think it was like in 2010, that just basically said, it acknowledged what I call the 2% rule, which is intact. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. If it has anything to do with Black people, it's 2%. So at that point, it was like less than 2% of all Black teams. What was it? That of all the venture capitals being allocated, less than 2% of it went to all Black teams, I think. And it couldn't even be measured for Latinos. It was like less than 1%. Now, back then, I think that the numbers for capital being raised, venture capital being raised, was like maybe in the $30 to $40 million range, something like that, annually. So it was a really tiny number. Now, ironically, when I was at Comcast, at one point I went to the team and I said, hey, I'm just going to give you the landscape. I'm just going to give you paint the full picture that if you are a Black founder today, where do you go to get your money? And I added up optimistically all of the people I knew in VC, and that was a short list, and how much capital they had access to, whether it was directly because they had a fund that was focused on diversity, or they were in the room helping to make a decision about investing in a diverse founder. And I couldn't come up with anything anywhere close to 2%. So it was an overstated number, but that was the number. That was a percentage. Now, fast forward 10 years later, and nothing has changed. The 2% rule still applies. And I would argue that we're now at $131 billion raised, I think, in 2019. There's no way that Black people got 2% of $131 billion. So it's still grossly overstated. So in essence, the numbers haven't changed. Like on a percentage basis, nothing has changed. And I think that even like at Comcast, it was a $20 million fund. It was not meant to change the numbers. It was ideally, it had the opportunity to change people's perspectives. And that required a different level of effort and a different level of focus. And I can't say that everyone had that kind of focus and that desire. And so as a result, that effort fell short when it was all said and done, because if it hadn't, we wouldn't be where we are today. It literally would have changed people's perspectives, and it didn't. And there were several other funds that came after it from other corporations, and none of those changed anyone's perspective either. So as much as everyone has done the victory lap for the last several years, at the end of the day, they didn't do anything. They literally didn't do anything to change the overall allocation. And thus, it's a problem that's much bigger than any single corporation.
So we've talked about the past and we've worked our way up to the present. Let's talk about the present and your current project, Aperture VC. What's unique about what you're doing there?
So Aperture is in many ways the offshoot of all the stuff we've already talked about.
Yeah.
Including this last thing that we just mentioned about the limitations of a single corporation to move the needle. There were so many different instances where I felt like over my time at Morgan Stanley and certainly with Comcast, that there was so much more that could be done. And I believe that there was no way we could rely upon traditional VCs to solve the problem because they've been around for 80 years. The problem, it still exists. So
yeah.
No reason to think they're going to jump on it and all of a sudden go do it. And so the notion here was that if you can create a platform that allows entrepreneurs to build their companies and to really kind of test the limits, their own and the limits of their own thinking and innovation and technology, then you've got a winning vehicle. You have a winning platform. The question is, what does that platform need to consist of? And if you say it's going to have one particular corporation and all of its assets, even if that one corporation was Amazon, it's not enough because it doesn't allow you to see, quote unquote, everything and react to the opportunities that exist as they appear to you. So bringing in multiple corporations that have different assets and different capabilities, the sum total of those assets or that pool of assets and capabilities equals this powerful platform upon which some fantastic companies can be built. And at the end of the day, if you look at the way VC works and you recognize they have all these different key players in the space, and they all say, we're going to raise a bunch of money, we're going to invest in some great companies, and here's what we can do for you. At the end of the day, they all want to try to do something very fundamental, which is how do we help you grow fast? And growing fast means you need customers, it means you need access, and you need distribution. Well, these same investors who are supposed to be so smart, they're all trying to make connections with these corporations so they can therefore make that access available and therefore you will be willing to take their money. And what I decided to do here is just say, hey, let's just cut that out altogether. Let's make it far more efficient. And let's have those corporations provide not just their capital, but access to their resources and to do so for the benefit of a far more diverse ecosystem. And getting back to your question earlier about whether or not the acts are genuine, this is a perfect way to say, it doesn't matter why you're doing it, but this is what we are asking you to do. And therefore, if you plug in, that is the one thing you have to do. If you plug into this system, then the system works whether you want it to or not. And ideally, you're going to discover that not only does it work for the entrepreneur, but it works for your company. And as a result of that, then you'll want to engage more. That's the overall objective. It's never been done before at this kind of scale for the benefit of this kind of problem. But we see people do this. We see companies do this all the time to get more self-driving cars on the roads or to pursue faster internet service and things of that nature. So it's not like they don't work together. We're trying to get them to work together for the benefit of the entire economy, just not just their specific sector or their specific state.
Is Aperture an impact fund or is it an early stage VC fund in the classic mold? It's a loaded question, I know.
It is a loaded question. So in the classic mold, it is an early stage VC fund. In the real world, it's both. if you do it well, you're going to have an impact, of course. But this is a space where most of the people that are highly regarded in the space and are considered to be super smart, don't know what to do right now. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to be better at investing in diverse founders, et cetera. For whatever reason, they're paralyzed intellectually about how to do that. If you do this, if you do Aperture well, Aperture is not going to, again, it's not going to change the numbers. It's not going to change the allocation, but it is going to change people's perspective. And once you do that, then you can change the numbers because everyone who's participating starts to think about things differently and act differently. My perfect corollary to that is everyone lauds Jackie Robinson for quote unquote breaking the color barrier. And I actually think that minimizes his impact. He didn't break the color barrier. He broke the access barrier. But it wasn't just him, because literally weeks after him came a whole list, a long list of other Black players that also got the opportunity. And then all of a sudden, everyone's like, well, why didn't we think about this before? And then you'd have all kinds of players of color playing baseball. That's the same thing here. We just haven't seen that level of impact take place, but it's coming. And hopefully, you know, Aperture will play a role in that. But I think that is ideally the expectation. It'll be an early stage fund with a tremendous amount of impact.
Good answer. Hey, what does the future of investing look like when you look at it through the Aperture VC lens?
What does the future of investing look like?
Yeah, what's hot? Where should we put our money?
This is not advice for anyone that's out there investing.
There you go.
I need to say that. I'll say this. I think that as the world becomes more familiar with diverse founders, I think what they're going to find is a lot of these folks don't have the luxury of, call it the luxury of loose thought. So you're not going to find many folks immediately out the gate deciding that I really need a juice machine because I'm too lazy to put the juice together myself. Like it's just not where the innovation is going to come from. But this idea that the things that I'm doing matter, and matter in a way that it's not just about me, it's about other people who are like me. It doesn't mean that they look like me, but it means that they can relate to this very same issue and challenge that I'm facing. I think that's where you're going to see a lot of innovation, if you will. And as technology continues to provide those capabilities, then we're going to be blown away by the types of solutions that are going to be created and the types of solutions that people are going to find are going to be more household names. So if I said right now, today, I'd say you should certainly be looking at financial services and financial technology.
Agreed.
Because the access to capital and the movement of capital is so critical to our communities. But then how does that, it's such an intertwined perspective, because once you do that, then you can't help but then also think about the plight of the entrepreneur today in a society where we've had these incredible shocks from the pandemic and other issues that have now led to, some people say 60% of businesses are going to go away. It just means they're going to start up again. It may be different founders of those businesses, but the businesses and the entrepreneurial spirit has not been killed by the pandemic, but it's going to reemerge in a completely different way. So now you're getting into access to capital, how important it is, and the movement of money in and out of those communities. So that brings you back to financial technology and financial services, that's going to be real. But it also takes you into entrepreneurship, retail, and commerce. And what does that look like in 2021 and beyond? And so you'll see innovations there as well. So, and then the last part I'll throw out there is, with all of that said, there's this new thing that's coming, which most people haven't given any attention to. But it's what people call the fourth industrial revolution, which is going to be driven by 5G and 5G technology. And so that is going to bring a whole nother level of possibility to the table, things that we can't even think of. I remember when 3G was supposed to be the thing. I remember when I spent time at AOL and we were looking at trying to bring internet access to every major municipality around the country, and what that could potentially do in making cities smarter. Well, that was the goal. And that was in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so you're talking about things that we can't even conceive of right now that are going to be happening over the next 10 to 15 years. And I think it's just not smart business to say that whatever it is going to happen, it's only going to be driven by the white guys that have access to the networks of capital and they went to the elite institutions. I think that is a really bad strategy from an investment standpoint in a world that is becoming more and more brown, more and more diverse every single day. I think you need to start betting on what those individuals are thinking and how they are thinking about using technology to make those things possible. So hopefully that helps.
Yeah.
So we're going to wind up now, right, Mark?
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, William. This was a great discussion. And I think the point about 5G is kind of interesting because we hear about the technology and we hear about all the applications, but can it be a leveler for society?
Yeah.
In a rural area, you could get the kind of internet access that you can only currently get if you're near a big city and you have Comcast, right? And I think that does equal economic opportunity, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it's honestly one of the things that concerns me the most about it, because it has that capability of, everyone talks about the digital divide. Well, the digital divide can be solved for, but it requires a lot of other pieces to work in concert. Obviously, the technology has to be there. That's great. It has to be accessible. That's where we've always fallen short.
Yeah.
And my fear is that if we don't pay attention and look at this from the policy perspective, as well as from corporation perspective, from a business opportunity, we have to bring all those things together in concert so that we start to narrow this gap. Because the pandemic has shown us one thing, which is that delta between the haves and have-nots is way bigger than anyone ever thought.
Yeah.
And even in the name of protecting lives, we've done the things that have made that divide and that gap even bigger.
Right.
So as we think about what do we do going forward, we have to be looking for the potential of technology to start to close those gaps and not exacerbate anymore. Because if we do it again this time, it may not be something we can recover from.
Yeah.
Structurally speaking, we just might not be able to recover from that. So we have to start today in many, many ways. We have to start today thinking about how is this new evolution, this new transformation, how is it going to work for us, whoever us is, however you define us in that conversation. We have to make sure those voices are heard.
Yeah. Well, this has been great, William. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit theinnovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.